Hey guys, welcome back to the Dad's Group podcast. My name is Blair.
And my name is Burnsy. Dad's Group is all about helping fathers and helping families. And that's what we try and do on this podcast. We're bringing you conversations that are going to encourage and support you in your fatherhood, but also resource you as a family.
Absolutely. And this week we have something exciting to share with you guys. As you know, Dad's Group is a non-profit organization and our goal is to create more local dad's groups around Australia. But we need your help. This week, we have launched our fundraising campaign called The Sockless Heroes. We all know a dad who is a hero to his family, but every year, that poor soul, that poor dad, gets another forgettable pair of socks. This Father's Day, skip the socks and give the gift of support and empowerment instead. Together, we'll create a brighter future for Aussie dads and their kids.
Awesome. Get amongst it, guys. It'd be awesome to have your support on that. But for now, let's chat about our episode, last episode with Jeff Braley from McCrindle.
Let's do it.
Part of that conversation was we talked about the multi-generational family. And that was really, you know, sort of looking at, we have multi-generational workplaces now with an older workforce, people staying in work longer. And you get this effect of, you know, multiple generations, multiple demographics, and their different sets of values, beliefs, et cetera. So how does that then apply to the family context when you have parents, kids, grandparents, sometimes even great-grandparents? That's a lot of different, you know, sort of beliefs about how a child should be raised and how families should be run and how do you navigate all of that. So really great insights into that. But Blair, you know, we talked about a whole heap of different topics within that episode. What stands out to you as sort of like the important area for your kids and their future?
Yeah, absolutely. I went to a wedding on the weekend and I got chatting with this guy a little bit later stage of life than I was. He had some teens and I was sharing with him. I love just sitting down with people in a later stage of life and just asking them questions, right? I just love learning that way through other people's experiences. And I was asking him about, you know, so I've just got my boys into basketball and one of his boys were in basketball, his older boys. And I said, you know, just sharing with him about how I want to do that because I want to use basketball to emphasize the values that I want to instill into our family, which is, you know, teamwork, being active and discipline and things like that. And I asked him the question, well, how did you get your boys interested in basketball? Because my boys, they're enjoying it, but they don't love it, right? Like, it's a bit of a mission to get them to get actually doing the practices and things like that. They're only young, I get it. But I was just wondering, like, how'd you get your boys really into basketball? And he was sharing about how, well, for one of his boys, he just loved it. He just loved basketball. He's just always doing it. You know, he just really enjoyed it just naturally. But for his other son, he didn't enjoy it. He just didn't like it. He just didn't like sport in general. And about how, you know, this guy I was talking to, how he had to learn to let go of his ideal situation or the plan that he had instilled and focused more on who his son was and the things that he enjoyed and focused on instilling his values in through that way. So his son really enjoyed drama and shows and things. So he took those same values that he was instilling with his boy in basketball and just applied it to what his other son was into, you know, into the drama and things. So he's just a lot more intentional focusing on who his son was and doing values that way rather than trying to say, you know, you need to, these values have to look this way. They have to play out this way. So yeah, I just really loved that. I really loved that. And I just really love the idea now is like, all right, well, who are my kids? You know, like rather than so focus on just the values, focus on who are my kids and how do my values line up with that? Like, how can I instill my values into who they are? That was what was really cool.
Yeah. And that's really been a theme the whole way along the podcast is that sense of if your kids had those values, those beliefs, those passions, and they know them, then like whatever happens with the future of education, the future work, et cetera, they're going to be okay. They're going to be able to navigate that because who they are as a person will be really solid. Yeah. But yeah, I think let's switch gears now. Let's look at this week's episode. And I got to chat with Simon Richardson from Safe on Social. It's a company that does all sorts of training and presentations about social media interactions in the corporate space, in schools, in families. And Simon comes with a lot of experience. He was a high school teacher for a long time, so he knows what that social environment looks like for young people. He was the mayor of Byron Shire for a long time. And so he's experienced, like, you know, sort of that hotbed of culture, and himself experienced a lot of cyberbullying and social media engagement. Mm. So he comes with a lot of experience, but he also now faces a very real task of raising teen and tween daughters solo, by the way, and helping them navigate the online world. So he definitely knows what he's talking about, and he brings a lot of great insights in this episode. So yeah, really great one for our dads and listeners this week.
Absolutely. Enjoy, guys.
Welcome to the Dad's Group Podcast. Simon Richardson, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
Simon, I've checked out your bio. I did a bit of a stalk, and you've got a pretty cool story. So I wonder if you could introduce yourself for our listeners. Tell us a bit about yourself, your work, and your family as well.
Okay, great. Look, my name's Simon Richardson, and I'm living in the Byron Bay area. I live in the hinterland, just inland from Byron Bay. I guess my history, going all the way back, I was all my study was in international relations and School of Foreign Service in Georgetown University in DC.
Yeah.
And then I had a moment where I really wanted to change the world, but realised that old saying of think global, act local had some currency. So I went from wanting to be in the Foreign Service to basically in the front lines of the environment movement, blockading, being part of trying to protect some of our wilderness areas, and actually relatively successful. We actually, most of the campaigns I was involved with, we won, which was good. From that, though, I guess I had a moment where I remember actually I was sitting on a whopping big tripod and waiting to be arrested, of all things. And I looked down and I actually saw a whole lot of my crew, as it were, on one side of the picket line, as it were, and loggers and others on the other side. And what struck me was really how similar they all were, both what they were wearing, but also the fact that everyone below me actually cared about the bush. They valued it differently. Some valued it for its timber, but they all chose that sort of lifestyle. They're all honest and, hardworking, and had a value system that I thought was actually more similar than different. And I guess from there, I really came to that conclusion that we need to change things by shaking hands rather than shaking fists. So from there, I went into politics, was elected mayor of Byron Shire. I was also a high school teacher between those two worlds. was mayor of Byron for 9 years, a councillor for 12, because I was on council for a little while teaching. And now for the last couple of years, I've been doing some creative projects. I've been doing some consulting and affordable housing and solar farm projects, and speaking on behalf of Safe on Social, trying to really educate and inspire our next generation to see their online experience as one that they've got choices in, and they can make good choices as to what they expose themselves to and how they behave and how they interact with others. So I've got plenty of plates spinning, and I my life very rich, and I've got two girls that I raise as a solo parent, which therefore keeps me very busy.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. I wonder, talking about your two girls, what's been a highlight of your parenting journey so far?
I think the highlight's been observing them become lovely young women.
Yeah.
Frieda is 14 and Matilda just turned 11.
Yeah.
And watching them come into their own unique beings, they are different. It's lovely. You begin to realise that as they age, you go from sort of holding them and sort of corralling them, maybe even tethering them, down to just sort of being a chaperone in a sense, helping guide and letting them come into their own space and their own knowing and their own resilience building, and so watching that occur and watching them, become really lovely young people people that other kids and other adults love to have around. Something that I really love, and the fact they make me laugh.
It's awesome. A lot of our, and this is great because a lot of our dads are, sort of in that new and expecting stage. So we love having dads like yourself who are a bit further along to be able to sort of give us hope that it does get easier. So I wonder, If you were to hop into a time machine, say, and go back to the delivery room of Frida and Matilda, what would you tell yourself then? And essentially then, what would you say to a newer expecting dad in that situation?
I'm actually quite lucky because I actually did a expectant father's course before Frida was born. And so I've got to say, if I look back now, I'd be saying to myself, what that course told you is true. Because really, this course was awesome. It was sort of a volunteer program, and it had men who were about to be dads for the first time across a whole broad spectrum. I mean, there was my story of, you know, years of IVF. There was an 18-year-old boy who sort of accidentally got his girlfriend pregnant. Yeah. Both of them got kicked out of their houses. Wow. There was a 55-year-old police sergeant who thought his day was done. There was a Balinese or Javanese artist who grew up where men didn't even muck around with their kids until they're old enough to go hunting with them. So part of that course was, first of all, they told us the two things, you know, when the birth first happens, all the women will rightfully or certainly in reality hover and nest around mum and bub and can be hard for the dad to get in and actually have some space. And so they said the two times a day or the two things a day that you can get at, access to are changing nappies and bathing them. So in that course, they taught us how to change nappies and how to bath. So as a result, from early on, and I did feel being pushed out by, you know, by the wider womanhood. Even, you know, the midwives wouldn't speak to me when they called to get a checkup. They said, I'll wait till your wife's there to get the update. But those moments, I mean, every day, a few times a day, I had one-on-one moments with the with my child, which was awesome. And the other lesson they really showed was, don't wait till the child's seven, you know, so you can kick a ball with them to connect. That every minute you spend or every hour you spend before seven is kind of like interest in the bank that you can call upon when you're a teenager, that you've got that relationship built. And I think both those aspects, one of very much a hands-on strategy, was really successful, and the other one of being present. You know, don't come home and say, I'm knackered, and make the, you know, and presume therefore the mum hasn't had a tiring day too. Get active with the kids and give them time and energy, and you can rely on that later. So they're the things that, again, if I had my time again, I'd be saying that course was spot on.
Absolutely. And I think the great thing now is that we're seeing more courses that are tailoring to men, whether that is your traditional sort of pre-birth courses where, you know, it's both, but they're talking to the father a lot more. But then also, like, a lot that are tailored specifically to men, and even dad's group, we offer some of those ourselves. So for the dads listening, don't feel locked out of it just because you're not the birthing partner. Like, there are courses and that provide a lot of that advice that is helpful for the whole of the fathering journey. So, no, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. And look, I think the other aspect too, and it's, I guess it sounds a little superficial, but it's, you know, look, I've always honoured the different genders. You know, when we got married, for example, we separated the men and the women, you know, in the congregation, as it were. You know, I value how we are different and how we, and you know, essentially we are different creatures who share some similarities and honour it. And, you know, sometimes even just sitting, you know, when you go, I guess, for dads who are in that process of pregnancy and, you know, you go to the antenatal classes and, you're learning about what's happening to the female body, which spins you out because, you know, it's really remarkable. And it's all about, okay, how can I support, you know, my woman, you know, the mum, which is really obviously crucially important. But sometimes you really, you know, you're sort of second-guessing what you can say and how you can say it and all that sort of stuff. Whereas I think it's sometimes just hanging with some guys, with the focus of parenthood or fatherhood allows you to, I guess, use the language you want to use, speak, you know, if I think we feel less, you know, less concerned about getting it wrong or saying the wrong thing or sounding a bit stupid or sounding a bit, you know, caveman, you know, whatever. So I think there is something really nice about just getting around the men who are connected with fathers. They're not just your mates, but getting, you know, sitting in a male group and just talking as men and you know, with all the you know, with all the idiosyncrasies that brings, I think it's really quite a nice way of help navigating your way through the process.
Oh, Simon, you're singing Dad's Group's chorus right now. This is exactly what we do. So this is awesome. Very light. Look, the reason I reached out to you and to Safe on Social is because that whole online world is just a continually evolving space. And I think, you know, as myself, a dad of a little toddler, like I'm already worried for him of what that's going to look like when he starts to engage that space and even beforehand, you know. So I wonder if we could dive into that now. And to begin with, if you could provide us with a bit of a broad overview, what does social mean now? Because it's not the same social media we engaged in when we were younger. So what does that look like now? What's that environment? And what are some of the aspects or features that parents need to be aware of?
Yeah, look, I think the social environment has just grown exponentially. So it's now a non-negotiable. It's now really for most human beings, let alone most kids, certainly from an age, and I would say that the longer it can be prolonged or pushed back before being embraced, the better. Like most things that have expansive capabilities or potentials, you know, on our lives. But bottom line is now it's an essential, integral part of kids' lives. Mm. And so, you know, just wishing it away is just not going to cut it. So it provides all, just like any environment. And I guess I equate it a little bit to the marine environment or the beach environment. You know, if I spoke for an hour about all the challenges or all the red flags about being in the beach, you know, what actually does skin, you know, does sunburn do to your body? What does melanomas do to your body? How do you actually die of skin cancer? You know, what are the rips? What's drowning like? And what are the dangers of rips or shark attack or, you know, randoms on the other side of the sand dune? I mean, you wouldn't go to the beach.
Yeah.
But we do, because we acknowledge that there are challenges out there, and we put things in place now. And we do it virtually without even thinking. Sunscreen on, put a hat on, you know, we don't kick the ball and kick sand right next to someone who's on a towel. We don't jump in the water if we can't swim properly. Even if we surf, we look at the ocean and work out, is it safe for us? So straight away we put certain strategies in place because we acknowledge that we're in a different environment to the, you know, the house environment. And the online one's the same. And I try to get kids to be sort of conscious that when you turn the screen on or turn the phone on, you're entering a new environment. And so put some strategies in place, so therefore you have a great time and you have a safe time, and you also don't impact on other people's experience. Yeah. So I think if we just see it as an environment that's really unavoidable and has all the amazing opportunities, but also obviously, you know, amazingly, you know, dangerous, you know, challenges that we need to be aware of. Mm. And so that's the first message I'll say to parents. And the other thing I'll say to parents right at the front is, the best way possible to protect your child and ensure your child is safe on social media is to build their self-esteem. That, you know, I can give them tricks and I can tell them ways where they can turn, you know, certain settings in a certain way to minimize it and make their profiles more private. And that will have a great effect to make them safer from predators, et cetera. But bottom line is, most of the predatory or addictive or antisocial or emotionally or, you know, essentially damaging aspects come from a lack of self-esteem and lack of self-confidence and knowing oneself. And if we can build that up, they're less likely to succumb to the cyberbullying. They're less likely to be seeking affirmations from someone they don't know. They're less likely to sort of crave an alternative world where they're successful, you know, because their real world, they feel that they're relatively successful in. So, you know, that's probably the essential key ingredient of keeping, you know, kids safe. And then from that, you learn the techniques just to minimize opportunities for people to do them harm.
It's probably reassuring for our dads to hear, because that piece of supporting their self-esteem is what we have to do for any environment that they're entering into, whether that's school, sport, whatever it might be. So it's essentially that same base key set, skill set of what we're trying to do with our kids, but we're just attaching it to a different environment.
Absolutely. And if we see it as that sort of natural extension of how kids spend time, again, we straight away start to get away from the fear. I mean, it's one of those things too that, you know, like I'm a solo parent. My wife died about 4 years ago. So I've been raising my kids on my own. And one of the things I do talk to when I give parent presentations, it's just a bit of a shout out to solo parents and for the wider community to look after each other.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of adults, whether it be dads, you know, who may not have real, you know, strong chops when it comes to, you know, an online presence, we're all time poor. We're all pretty exhausted when we come home from work. We're all pretty, you know, preoccupied with maybe five or six things that are buzzing through our brain. So quite often, social media policy with our kids or some, you know, some really engaged conversation with our kids can sometimes just be a bridge too far. And yeah. As parents, we look and we see the kids and they're not making much noise. They seem content. It's a bit of a babysitter, you know, sort of vibe that we may think, well, that was TV for us. Can't be doing that much harm. They're just playing a game. I hear them laugh occasionally. It's all good. And so we don't engage with it. And that's a real danger. We need to make sure that we're engaging with their life and in their online world. So if they get into some trouble, they can come to it. If we basically just dismiss that world and know nothing about it, they're either not going to tell us when something goes wrong because they think we're going to judge them badly because we don't like that world to begin with, or we're not going to be able to really create any support for them because we're not going to know how it all works. So, you know, I think, you know, especially for those single parents who are perhaps even more time poor, but being in relationships regardless, you know, it is about engaging with the kids, even just asking them, what game are you playing? And can I have a go? So you get to know what the game is. You don't have to play it a second time. But then you sort of can get to know the game. You can ask them, hey, do you know where the block and report settings are in case someone tries to, you know, connect with you? So therefore you know that they know. And so it gives you an opportunity to chat, you know. And what you want, of course, is that one moment when in the back of the car and you're driving home from school or whatever and they ask a question or they bring up something. You want them to be feeling safe to do that, and you want to be prepared when they do it to give some sort of decent response. So part of it also as a dad, you know, I've also co-created with Kira from Safe on Social a boys-specific program called Bites of Passage, where we look at the wider conversation about what is it to be a young man growing up in society and therefore online and how we deal with consent and how we deal with the toxic masculinity and the difference between a good man and a real man and why If you ask the kids for five or six words to describe a good man, why are they different to if you ask about a real man? You know, what boys are in a sense subjected to as far as what they think society expects of them, and that can therefore impact on their behaviour online as far as their treatment of women, you know, or each other. So, you know, we are looking at Safe and Social. And we're also creating, you know, a girls' program, and I'm sort of running and co-creating the guys' one because I think again, you know, there is slightly different usage and sensitivities when it comes to online. And the more we know, the more we can share, and the more we can embed it, the education with our kids into the wider setting. You know, that consent, taking photos of people, for example. You know, if you didn't like it when your dad took a photo of you at first day of school and posted up on Instagram and you didn't like that, well then, and you think therefore they should have asked you, well then you therefore naturally have to accept that other people should be asked as well. And so we try to broaden that conversation of, you know, how are you feeling about it and therefore how would other people feel about it? And let's bring concepts of respect and privacy and consent in real relationships in the flesh, but also real relationships in the virtual world. So, look, there's so much for us to unpack and discuss, and we're at least lucky that kids are interested in the topic because it's part of their world.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, part of that too, of what you're saying is all of that consent and respect is sort of assumed, and then therefore it's assumed in the digital space. And so I think the more, as you say, we can be explicit about it. And that example too of the dad taking a photo of his kid on the first day of school and posting it, I wonder, could we sort of focus in on that? Like for dads particularly with young bubs, and you see dads who are so excited and they're riding this wave of, you know, fatherhood. We can be engaged. We can be intimate. We don't have to, you know, be the stoic sort of dad. And they're so proud posting photos of their kids on social, their baby, you know, their families, that sort of thing. What are some things that dads need to be aware of when they're posting photos of their kids, particularly from that really young age, where the kid can't voice any sort of consent or permission?
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. And, you know, I think, and especially now with the advent of AI and the ability to, you know, grab faces and do, you know, some deep fake morphing technology and these sorts of things, the more images we have of people online, the more opportunities people have, you know, to steal that identity or distort it or use it against it. So we need to be very careful. I guess I would, you know, break it down perhaps into a few different, maybe even age groups. I think, you know, look, when, you know, when your kid's just a little bit of blubber and, you know, dribble and, you know, cute little things, you know, we as adults need to make decisions because they're not really sentient beings to a certain point, you know, like, you know, they're still freaking out with peekaboo. So, you know, they think we actually disappear, you know. So, you know, I think they're the, at that sort of level, especially when your face and your body's going to change so dramatically, you know, I don't think there's any great harm in posting some photos to your friends of little Johnny, you know, swaddled up in, you know, and looking as cute as a button. You know, I think, you know, I think we can perhaps give ourselves a little bit of leeway when it comes to that. I think, though, in general, we need to have a real concept that if we're sharing photos of kids or something, A, we really need to be sending it to people who know us and know them, you know, and so this is part of the problem with online, especially for our kids. You know, they're called friends or followers or likes. You know, all of these things are words that we all want as part of a herd animal that we are. We all want more friends. We all want more followers. So most of us, if we're honest, if we're somewhat engaged online, have probably got a whole lot of friends who we don't really know that well. You know, they've just been living in our area and all that sort of stuff. And so therefore, you know, do we know them enough to trust images of our kids, you know, with their school uniform on, you know, if we're showing in front of our house? I would say no. You know, if you did a friend group or a family group and you're sending images, you know, to, you know, friends and family, well, you know, even then, of course, they can share it. But bottom line is you're going to be far more protected because you're far more private. I think as they start getting a bit older, though, you know, and even from an age, you know, those late single figures, you know, that sort of second half of primary school and beyond especially, we do need to be very careful about sharing their image and making sure that, again, people can't exploit what we're sharing. You know, and then, of course, on the flip side of that, so not only just from a safety perspective, and as I said, that sort of deep fake, you know, morphing sort of technology, and people can feel free to jump online, for example, type in Tom Cruise deep fake on YouTube, and you can see how easy it is for someone to grab a photo of an image of someone's face and then put it onto another body and do and make all sorts of different, you know, claims about it, or, you know, the mind boggles as to how we can actually use some of this technology. So the more that we've got our settings in private, the more that we're only showing people that we really need to, and then the question of consent comes in. And if we want our kids, when they're 14 and 15 and 16 and 17, when they're at that party and they might have had that sly drink or they've got that relationship and they're getting pressured, there's this question of, you know, show us your boobs and let me take a photo or doing something a bit stupid. If we want them to have really strong consent muscles that have been well exercised so they feel empowered to either not ask or say no if they are asked, it can start with us role modeling that by asking them, is it okay if I take your photo? And if they say no, accept it. You know what I mean? They may not want the photo taken, or they might say, can I take this photo and just share it with granny, whatever. Then they feel powerful because we're asking them, or we're actually validating them as human beings and validating their privacy and their ability to say yes and no. And then they're going to start, going to become, second nature, and they're going to, when they're later without us at parties or in some sort of social setting, going to be part of who they are, demanding consent or asking for. So, you know, we can role model that behaviour. Mm. So I guess on a very technical perspective, as far as the technology goes, I think we really need to be very, very careful and aware of what we're sharing. From a privacy or just a consent exercise, I think as they get older, you know, and we think they're now able to sort of make that discerning decision, we need to ask them. And I think there's also an issue too of we need to be conscious of why we're actually doing it. I've got some friends who, to be honest, I actually worry for, because it's like every second photo they're posting, it's of their 8-year-old boy, and it's like, yeah, you're almost living your life through this little kid. You know, clearly you're not really asking him. You've now got 500 photos of him in the last year and a half. I mean, it's like, at what point do you let that go and maybe share your own life and not have to kind of, you know, almost absorb some of the energy of, you know, I think there's something going on there that we need to ask ourselves sometimes. Why are we so besotted with the need to share that? Sometimes it is just if it's with our friends and family who we love watching each other's family grow up, that's one thing. If it's actually somehow because it makes us bigger or more successful or more whatever, well, then I think there's a bigger thing we need to be looking at.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I think the modelling, as you say, is so critical to that. And you know, my wife and I, we've actually like communicated to all the family, all the aunts, you know, like just ask him if he wants a cuddle before you go in for the cuddle. Like, I mean, I grew up with the come give your auntie a cuddle, you know. But even just modelling that there, and we sort of hope that will reinforce some of that, particularly because he's a boy, that by the time he's older, he'll have a good sense of, you know, consent isn't just in terms of the sexual, but it's all about the whole of the relationship and how we engage with people. So I think you're right. Like, that modeling is so critical.
Yeah. I mean, it's ultimately just asking permission. It's actually honoring the value of the other person, you know, to think, okay, they should have a saying in all of these things. You know, there's a certain stage where we know we have to lead, you know, we have to, you know, we are the parents, you know? And so sometimes, to be honest, part of our talks, you know, I think when it comes to those sorts of things, or when it comes to deciding what your kids watch or what they don't watch, or what games they play or what they don't play, we need to parent up, and we need to make the tough decisions, because, you know, someone who's 12 doesn't still necessarily have the sentience to understand the implications and repercussions that we do, you know. And so, you know, there are times where we need, and that's a balancing act, and that's where we're all grappling with, what degree do we hold? And to what degree do we, you know, let loose, you know, and getting that right for the right reasons. And you're right. I think in so many of these things, the more that they are surrounded by a respectful engagement, an inquiry as to what they want and what they don't want and what they need and what they don't need, it becomes second nature for them to expect it of others or to give it to others.
Absolutely. And a lot of the questions I've asked have been about how we as parents can support our kids, but we have to name, and you've used the word a couple of times, predators. And I guess, how do we as parents and how do we as dads particularly have that conversation with our kids about predators? Because again, as you said at the start, like, we don't want to scare them off because this is part of their world now, but how do we have a constructive conversation with them? And how do we, you know, obviously there's that self-esteem part as you talked about, but how do we build their awareness of what is an unsafe person, a predator, and some of those things that they can really get themselves into hot water around?
Yeah, look, I mean, the first thing is talking, you know, and actually having the conversations. And even if we bumble through it, you know, like being willing to have those conversations and even accept, even say, hey, look, I don't really know this world so much. You know it. Can you tell me? So one of the things that we will talk to in Safe on Social, in the parents group, is creating a contract with your kid and co-creating it. You know, so you work out your times and you know, certain rules. So it could be, for example, if you play a game, you don't play with people you don't know. You grab your friends around you, you share a password so you can find each other on that game, and therefore you can play with other people, but you know them. Or rules like don't, you know, converse or engage with people you don't know. Or you know, every game that you play, you must share with the parents so we get to know it, and you need to be able to show us where the block and report settings are in case someone is, you know, encroaching on your privacy and you want to be able to get rid of them. So you can sort of embed certain rules that you can co-create. One of the things that I also do with my girls and we recommend is, you know, for example, my oldest, Frieda, is starting to be interested in Instagram. So for me, it's like, okay, cool. Write me a one-page essay where you show me some knowledge about Instagram. You know, what's it about? How does it work? Give me a paragraph or so. Or what are some of the dangers in Instagram, particularly when it comes to predators and those things? And then what are you going to put in place to make sure you stay safe? So that alone means they're researching it, they're owning it. I'm not telling them it's dangerous. You know, they're discovering it themselves, and they're actually starting to empower themselves. Okay, I'll put these things in place: my fake name, privacy settings. You know, the no communication to an unknown, direct message. You know, these sorts of things. So, you know, you can have these conversations with the kids. Put it this way: if you think they're old enough to play a game, they're old enough to have a conversation about doing it safely. If they're old enough to be on Snapchat, they're old enough to have a conversation with you as a parent about, you know, what are the dangers and putting them in place. And if they don't want to do that, well, you say, cool. You know, again, this is where we parent up. We sort of say, well, these, you know, as a family, these are what we want to put in place. Just like I won't let you go to the beach on your own if I don't think you're a great swimmer, and you won't swim between the flags. I can't let you swim in the ocean. But, you know, so we can have these conversations. The concept of a predator, you know, is obviously known to them because they grow up with, you know, strange danger. And so it's more about embedding the fact that that happens online, and that can be things like, you know, role-playing how it can work and talking to them about some of the techniques that predators put in. So in our Safe on Social and our Bites of Passage sessions, I'll go through, you know, various sextortion techniques of the questions that they'll ask. Or if they're playing a game, you know, put your hands up, who's been asked to be your boyfriend or girlfriend, or put your hands up if you've been asked to send a photo of your feet, you know, and they all laugh and giggle. And then when I unpack the fact that that's the second most common question of a predator, because it's trying to normalize the idea and the action of taking photos of different parts of your body upon request. So therefore, later on, when it comes to, you know, showing parts of your body that are far more problematic, the person's already, you know, well down the path. As soon as you start to unpack that, they freak out, you know. Yeah. So again, it's like they begin to realize, wow, okay, that's a red flag. If someone's asking me that, you know, and so, you know, knowledge, just telling them how these sorts of, you know, sorts of things work. So letting them know the average age of a gamer is, you know, 34 to 36. You know, they think it's 12 or 15. So when you started to share a bit of the facts around it and some of the techniques around it, well, then they're more equipped to be able to spot it and avoid it. And it's important they know, A, they can come to you. So, for example, one of the things that we'll teach the parents is that when they're creating the contract, there's fair enough to have a punishment in there. Well, what happens if you do 4 hours and the house rules is 2 hours? Or what happens if you've got it in your bedroom and the house rules are to keep it in the lounge room? Things like that. Of course, there needs to be punishments. But one of the things that we'll tell is when it comes to a young person making a mistake online, that's actually endangering them, make sure the punishment isn't to take their game away or to take the social media away, because they won't tell us. So for example, it could be if you're playing a game, you know, in the wrong, you know, longer than you should, or in the wrong room, et cetera, and you get yourself into some trouble and you tell us, the normal punishment of no games for a week won't apply. You can mow the lawn instead for a week. Because what we don't want is kids not telling us, because we're about to take the best thing in their life away from them. Yeah. You know, so little things like that. We want to make sure that they always know we've got our back, no matter how much they screw up, accidentally, deliberately, how much things happen to them, or they do to others. That we've got their back when they come to us. So it's about creating that space so they're always feeling comfortable enough to say, "Hey, Dad, help."
Yeah. Beautiful. Simon, I want to say thank you. You've shared with us some incredible insights into that online space and some really great tips and skills of how we can help our kids navigate it. for all our dads and families that are listening, where would be the best place for them to access, say, that the boys and girls programs or other information from Safe on Social?
Yeah, look, I mean, go on social media. I mean, look, you can find us in the phone book. You can go old school. But, we've actually got a really good Facebook page where anyone can join. And to be honest, we're not flogging things through it. It's more about updates. You know, if we know, for example, TikTok challenges, which can be quite dangerous, we'll share them. Any new research, any new things that we think people should know, we just share it. So it can be just one good source that you just connect with, mm-hmm. delve in, or just have a look at some of the notifications, and just keep skilled up, as much as we can. It's one of those ones. Ignorance isn't going to be a defence for us, because the kids aren't ignorant. They know how it works. They're increasingly going to know how it works. So we've got a bit of a responsibility to know enough so we can actually help them and not be, sort of bystanders in the whole process. So that's a great one. Just go onto the Facebook Safe on Social page and feel free to join them, and we'll share any info we've got. Or, of course, the Safe on Social website, under the address you can imagine, safeonsocial.com. And we've got all the access to all the presentations we put on, all the different classes we do, as far as, we're creating modules now where people can do a 12-week, 12-step sort of program at their own leisure from home and skill up, targeted for kids, for girls and for boys and parents, etc. So we've got lots and lots of different opportunities for them to tap in. And also, they can speak to their school and say, hey, can you engage, someone like Safe on Social to come in and talk to the kids and the parents and the teachers, is what we do, on a daily basis. And because sometimes doing it in a school setting can be great, because the kids are there together, so again, it's a collective sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Parents can ask the questions that, they may not individually or whatever. So sometimes we always know it takes a village to raise a kid. To raise a child. And the online world is the same. The more we can act as a village and support each other, the more, safe our kids will be.
That's it. Awesome. Thank you so much, Simon. Appreciate your time.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. And we also want to thank our listener for tuning in today. If you haven't already, go check out our website at www.dadsgroup.org. In this space, we've got some awesome resources for support for families, new and expecting families. There's a lot of mental health support there by some amazing organizations. On this website as well, you can also support Dad's Group through purchasing our merchandise, or a solid donation would be amazing and help us impact the lives and of new and expecting families all around Australia. But thank you guys so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, guys.